Welcome to the Caring Hands Soup Kitchen Hour, sponsored by the Joseph V. Leahy Funeral Home of Kingston, New York, offering caring, compassionate, and personalized service. At the Joseph V. Leahy Funeral Home, there's a commitment to ensure licensed funeral professionals guide you through the experience of your loss. And it's always wise to pre-plan. So call Leahy's and tell them Pastor Kelly sent you. It works out nicely that Pastor Kelly's first story for us today is about a funeral.
Sweet friends, I hope you're comfy and cozy, because I have to tell you, things around here stay interesting. I survived the Grand Inquisition at Mount St. Horrendus. Actually, it was much better than I expected. I was blessed with a very loving band of inquisitors. Had one rough spot answering a question involving a lemon meringue pie and a rabbi, but who wouldn't? Other than that, I managed to baffle them with my fancy footwork. Seems I am now a probationary member of the elite squad of radicals, reformers, and old sinners known as the Methodist clergy. And if that isn't scary enough, I visited a crematorium. First, of course, I officiated a funeral. I kept thinking of that Robert Frost poem, and since they weren't the ones dead, they went about their business. Was that Frost? I looked in my Frost collection, but I couldn't find the poem. It's haunting me. Alas, back to death. The church I'm serving needs to grow so badly, it can't afford to lose any members, so death is forbidden. At our very first coffee hour, I explained to them, gently yet firmly, that they are not allowed to die. They may only reproduce. Babies, not funerals, that's our motto. They got a real kick out of that. The youngest person in the congregation is pushing 70. However, someone who hasn't attended the church in years but still felt connected to the congregation passed away. This was acceptable, since he wasn't mailing in an offering. I got a call from the local funeral director, and with the aid of my trusty book of funerals, I helped Mr. Francis, his friends call him Frankie, bland a Bavarian, move on. At least I hope that was his name, and I hope I helped. What is it we promise? To do no harm? This is such a dangerous job. Just for starters, there was the name of the deceased. You'd think a girl could catch a break and for a first funeral bury a Smith or a Jones, but not so for me. I had to get a guy whose grandfather was born somewhere east of Istanbul. I paced the back of the funeral parlor practicing that last name over and over. Yet the more I said it, the less certain I became. Blanda Bavarian, oh, Lord have mercy. I checked with one of the guys working at the funeral parlor. The name of the deceased, it's at But the guy just smiled and walked away. I was certain I'd call the poor man Branda Barbarian before the whole thing was over. 10 minutes before the service began, I saw the funeral director mouthing the name with great uncertainty. By the time I left, nobody knew what to call the guy. Although, I imagine I did something right, because the same funeral director called me back this week, and I did funerals 2 and 3 on Wednesday in the morning and afternoon. Nothing like packing all your hands-on funeral experience into one day. For the full effect, the last service was held at the graveside during a thunderstorm. I was impressed by the size of the funeral home's umbrellas. In between funerals, by invitation of the funeral director, who had to pick up the remains of the afternoon deceased, I visited the crematorium. I'd never really thought much about how the deceased get around. Turns out funeral directors drive pretty nice cars. And when it comes to crematoriums, turns out the guys who work there are hilarious. At least these two were. Yet a tension settled over me listening to the men joke about their work. And though I tried hard to remain professional, they were good. Two of the funniest human beings I have ever met. And it was obvious that they were pulling out all the stops, performing their best crematorium routine for the new pastor in town. The funeral director seemed to be having a good time, too. Actually, I confess we were both hunched over with belly laughs watching that cremation. I fretted a little for fear of irreverence, but I did linger, grounding myself with a shoulder against the wall, half shielded in the corner closest to the door. I lingered and laughed out loud, watching a coffin-sized box disappear into a contraption best described as a big oven in the wall. Conflicted though I was, I laughed until I cried, and finally pulled myself together, realizing, of course, that the crematorium guys used humor as a defense against a ghoulish job. But that only made me wonder if they're funny when they're not at the crematorium. I will say that with all of 3 funerals under my belt, I have a lot to learn. Fortunately, one thing dawned on me early. You can't take anything for granted. If the devil is in the details, God must be there too. It can't ever be the 4th funeral or even the 55th funeral. For those gathered to mourn, it is the only funeral. Which reminds me of that Robert Frost poem again. A clue came to me during a yawn-turned epiphany. Seems I had the line wrong, but the idea right. That's why it was haunting me. It's a warning about the bureaucracy of death. It's called departmental. It's about insects. Elusive yet whimsical notions of ants finally led me to the right page. Here's the end of it. It couldn't be called ungentle, but how thoroughly departmental. If I officiate at 100 funerals, may I always remember Robert Frost. With love, Darlene.
Thank you for listening to the Caring Hands Soup Kitchen podcast. Caring Hands feeds over 500 folks per week and houses the homeless as Ulster County's warming center. Please, friends, donate today. Look for the Caring Hands Soup Kitchen Facebook page or go to caringhandssoupkitchen.org. Or you can send a check to Caring Hands, P.O. Box 1099, Kingston, New York, 12402. All donations are tax deductible and greatly appreciated. That's Caring Hands Soup Kitchen and Pantry in Kingston, New York, where Reverend Darlene Kelly is the executive director. All stories and all rights to them belong to Reverend Darlene Kelly. Please don't copy or use anything on this podcast without her permission. More of Reverend Kelly's stories may be found on her WordPress blog, MethodistToHerMadness.com. Pastor Kelly's next letter is all about a baptism.
Sweet friends, hope you are very well and sitting down somewhere relaxing, because I long to tell you how interesting things stay around here. I know it's hard to believe, but being a pastor is one of the best jobs in the world, also one of the hardest, but mostly it's incredible. The other night, Sunday night, the phone rang a little before 9. A nurse in the intensive care unit was on the other end. She said there was a family at the hospital waiting with a loved one in critical care. They were preparing to take him off the respirator. They hadn't been to church in several years, but they were Methodist, and they wanted a Methodist minister. Would I come? And I thought about that hymn, Here I Am. And I thought, gee, this is what I said I'd do. I said, Lord, send me. So here I am. And I wanted to cry, but there was no time. Instead, I told the nurse I was on my way, and I stopped to put on my suit and collar and grab the Bible and the book of worship, and off I went in the snow. I did have a bit of trouble getting out of the driveway. The driveway's on a hill, and I'm not used to driving in the snow. And it was snowing, real snow. And it was hard to see. and I'm afraid that I've done a bit of damage to the poor Rose or Sharon. I backed right into it, not once, but twice, and now it's leaning to one side. Between the snow and my anxiety, it took forever to get to the hospital, but I made it. I got to the intensive care unit, and it was dim and quiet. And there was a family huddled around the bed of their dying father and husband. 3 grown children, 1 son-in-law, and 1 wife, all weeping. All facing one of the worst nights of their lives, and even the son-in-law is crying. And I kept reminding myself to stay quiet, repeating a prayer over and over, "Guide my feet and bridle my mouth." And I introduced myself and take a deep breath and move to the side out of the way. And I realize I've been praying since the phone rang and it just doesn't feel like enough. Then one of the 2 daughters rises and wipes the tears from her eyes and gathers herself up and says, "I've been so worried. My father was never baptized." My mouth opens, and I'm saying the words before my brain can form them. "Would you like me to baptize him now? Oh, could you?" She brightens right up. She seems very relieved. Everyone in the room comes alive for a moment. There, in the stillness and helplessness, on the edge of a hospital bed facing death, there's now a plan, some action. Something can be done. There can be grace and sacrament. And they seem to sigh in relief together, a collective family sigh, a good sigh on a very bad night. So now I think I know why I'm here, though I am no more confident, and I go out to check with the nurse and buy myself a minute to lean against the hospital wall in that dim light, to breathe deep breaths and talk to God some more, and find the right pages in the Book of Worship, the rite of baptism, and a prayer for the dying, one to the other. At the nurse's station, I ask if a baptism is okay, because I suddenly realize that baptism is about water, and I'm going to sprinkle water on the head of a man who's hooked up to all kinds of monitors and machines. And the nurse tells me it's fine, but to put on gloves and a gown. They're not sure what's killing him. And so I do. And the tap on the hospital room sink is hard to push at first. And I find a stack of Dixie cups, and I'm trembling a little, and I fill it too full, and have to pray again to get just the right amount of water to stay in the cup. And I realize I've only baptized a baby doll before this, a baby doll in a classroom in seminary. And now there is a human being in a hospital bed, a real soul, a real sacrament. And I take a few more breaths and move to the bedside, grasping my book of prayer, balancing my little pool of water in the Dixie cup. And the family makes a circle around the bed. And there is so much love in the room, over and under all the sadness. And everyone finds a way to hold hands and touch the dying man in the bed, the father, the husband, the man they love so much who is slipping away from them. And we pray together. And I make the sign of the cross with my wet glove finger and baptize a dying man in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. And we pray some more and wait for the doctor. We wait together till the monitors and the machines are gone. And I am amazed that I am with this family, that I am witnessing the intimacy of death, declaring the promise of new life with a Dixie cup full of water, that this is the job I signed up for, that it's a snowy night and I am the pastor. And I stay until I sense my job is over, and I drive home through cold, white quiet, and I think how incredible is God's grace. Love, Darlene.
Thank you again for listening to the stories of Reverend Darlene Kelly of the Caring Hands Soup Kitchen and Pantry, Kingston, New York. Won't you consider a tax-deductible donation to Caring Hands today? Caring Hands feeds the community. Look for the Caring Hands Soup Kitchen Facebook page or go to caringhandssoupkitchen.org. Or you could send a check to Caring Hands, P.O. Box 1099, Kingston, New York, 12402. This podcast is made possible by the Joseph V. Leahy Funeral Home in Kingston, New York. Our next story, The Miracle Peaches, may be found on Reverend Kelly's blog, Methodist to Her Madness, on WordPress.
This is the story of the Miracle Peaches. It's a true story. It happened nearly 30 years ago in Atlanta, and it began in a cramped, windowless room full of telephones. In a simpler world in early spring, everybody and anybody who wanted to work in the theater flocked to Atlanta for the regional auditions. Georgia was a right-to-work state. No union cards required, a place you could get your foot in the door. So I called a friend and arranged some housing, and off I went to join the pilgrimage south. Early in the week, I felt good about getting a few callbacks, but by Friday, I knew I'd been cut loose, and the best offer on the table was working in the box office phone room selling season tickets. I had to take it. I didn't have enough money for the bus ride back to Baltimore. I met Lucy on our first night working the phones. Short and petite, with a head full of wild black curls, Lucy looked more like an extra in a fairy tale than a set designer. But Lucy wanted to be the greatest set designer that ever breathed air. And the fact that she was sitting upstairs in the phone room instead of building a set downstairs in the theater was almost more than she could bear. We were both a bit miserable, and maybe it's true that misery loves company, because Lucy and I became old friends the moment we met. Lucy fascinated me. For starters, I had at least 5 inches and 40 pounds on her. In a room full of adults, Lucy looked like a child, and she inspired acts of chivalry and flutters of protective nurturing wherever she went. Lucy triggered a call to aid and defend, and I was not immune. Without many friends in town, I started following Lucy's lead. She was hard to keep up with. Kinetic energy with a cause, Lucy saw injustice and suffering in daily life. She had a keen awareness of others, what they felt, what they experienced, and what they needed. But her attention to the world's suffering never accentuated its pain. In some inexplicable way, Lucy's diligent compassion made the world feel safer and more manageable. As though by sheer will, energy, and expectation, the world's greatest set designer could turn her attention to the nations and set things right. She was the only person I'd ever met who was both comforting and exhausting at the same time. And she was the only person I'd ever met who was suffering in the name of set design. Suffering actors clustered in packs, preening at every watering hole in town, but suffering set designers were a rare breed. Most folks jostled to be in the spotlight. Lucy longed to figure out the perfect placement of its beam. It didn't take long before Lucy and I started leaving the phone room together at the end of the night. We'd dig in our pockets for change, pool our money for a quart of Bud and a pack of Marlboros. Then we'd roam the suburban neighborhood behind the theater, hunting for a quiet piece of curb under a good tree. And we'd sit in the growing dark together, passing the beer back and forth, talking and smoking. And sooner or later, on a warm Georgia night, on a quiet curb, under the right tree with a quart of beer, the talk will turn to God. A self-proclaimed agnostic, Lucy didn't deny the possibility of God. She just didn't see much evidence of God's existence. For Lucy, life seemed too hard to have anybody who gave a damn running the show. If God is there, I certainly haven't seen him, she declared, in a louder than usual voice. You could always try praying, I suggested. You've got nothing to lose. The next night, Lucy bounded into the phone room carrying a large brown paper bag. She placed the bag gently on her desk. I could tell it was from Kroger's and it was full of something, but I wasn't sure what. Lucy smiled when I asked about the bag, but she didn't answer. She just kept smiling. And I realized that I'd never seen her smile like that before. "I'll tell you after work," she said finally, sitting down at her desk. She picked up the phone and turned her attention to her call sheet, but she was still smiling. Finally, the clock struck 9, and the hum of the phone room died down, and Lucy looked across that room at me, and with one smooth and deliberate move, she rose from her chair and lifted her bag, and the new smile reappeared. I simply hung up the phone in the middle of the call and followed her out the door. Lucy tortured me with silence until she found just the right spot to talk. But I knew something big was coming. She'd forgotten all about the cigarettes and beer. "Peaches," Lucy proclaimed, opening the bag and lifting high a perfectly plump, fuzzy piece of fruit. "Miracle peaches." She lifted the peach even higher, extending her arm as far as it would go and turning her wrist slightly to the right and then to the left. She seemed to offer the peach for praise to an absent crowd. It was a fine-looking peach. And we both stared, frozen in place for a moment, breathing in the spring air, two girls hanging out on a cul-de-sac, admiring a peach. But I knew more was coming, and I didn't have to wait long. Without taking her eyes off the peach, Lucy slowly lowered her arm. I watched the peach's dramatic descent. And when the peach, still cradled in Lucy's palm, was hip high, it caught the light from the street lamp. She'd found the spotlight's beam, and she let the peach linger in its glow for a moment before repeating her line, "Miracle peaches." Then she looked me straight in the eyes and with a clear, cool voice declared, "Now I believe in God." "When I woke up this morning," Lucy testified, "I was hungry, hungry and penniless." Her choice of the word penniless struck me as odd at first, but then I realized that Lucy and I had both been living on change for so long that she was probably being literal. She'd run out of pennies. "It's hard to know what's worse, selling their lousy overpriced tickets or getting them to pay you for it. And I'm tired." Lucy lowered her arm, but she still cradled the peach in her palm. "And I thought about what you said last night, how I didn't have anything to lose. And so I prayed. And I said, 'God, I don't know if you're out there, but this is Lucy, and I'm hungry. Hungry and penniless, and if you are there, I need your help.' And I got dressed, and I started walking. I didn't even have anywhere to go. I was just walking and thinking about God, listening to my stomach growl, and praying for real over and over in my head, 'God, if you're out there, please, I'm hungry.' And for some reason, I looked up. And I was standing in front of this church downtown. I don't even know where I was for sure. But there was this church. And the doors were open. And I went inside. And it was lovely, cool and dark and quiet. And I just sat for a while. I don't even know how long I was there. But I think I was praying the whole time. And when I went back outside, there was a peach tree. I didn't notice it on the way in, but there it was, this amazing, beautiful peach tree, and it was full of fruit right there in the middle of downtown, and there are peaches just hanging from this tree. And I picked one and bit into it, and it was the most incredible peach I've ever eaten. And I just stood there eating peach after peach. Lots of people are walking by me on their way to work, but nobody pays any attention to the peaches or to me. So I just hang out under this incredible tree and eat and eat. And there are so many peaches, all within arm's reach, and they are so good. And this thought pops in my head, and I think, hey, I should take some peaches with me. I need to share these peaches. But I don't have a bag. So I'm trying to load as many as I can in my arms, when suddenly there's a man in a suit handing me a Kroger's bag. And he smiles, and he hands me the bag and keeps on walking just like that. I think he may have been an angel with a Kroger's bag. Lucy laughed at herself and took a deep breath. Then she opened that Kroger's bag and handed me a perfect peach. I knew when I was eating those peaches that God was there and he didn't want me to be hungry. And I can't explain it, but everything is different now. She closed her bag and lifted it to rest on her hip. These are miracle peaches. And now Lucy believes in God. I don't remember how I responded to Lucy's story. I only remember Lucy. And I remember that we carried that bag of peaches back to the boarding house where I was staying. And we traded a few of them to my kind landlady for bread and salami, and we shared a feast. And Lucy managed to eat 2 salami sandwiches without letting go of the peach she cradled in her palm.
You're listening to the Caring Hands Soup Kitchen Hour, sponsored by the Joseph V. Leahy Funeral Home of Kingston, New York, and supporting the Caring Hands Soup Kitchen, where Reverend Darlene Kelly is the executive director. Reverend Kelly's final story is also true. It happened in New York City while Pastor Kelly was attending seminary and bartending in Greenwich Village.
I lugged my bicycle down the stairs and across the subway platform because it was pouring when I got off work, and I hate to ride in the rain. There's no wet as bad as bike wet. While I waited for the train, I propped a book open on the handlebars. Seminary requires constant reading. But the book distracted me, and I didn't pay enough attention to my proverbial surroundings before pushing the bike into the subway car and grabbing hold of the pole. I positioned the bike and myself in a comfortable balance and continued to read. Then the doors closed and the train pulled out of the station, and it was too late. It's very quiet, I thought, aware suddenly of the atmosphere and my own vulnerability. For a moment, I kept my head down, trying to focus on the page, hoping that the fear and apprehension filling my bones were just false alarms. Then I forced myself to lift my head and take in the view. A large group of young African-American males stared at me from the other end of the car. There were 12, maybe 15 of them, all teenagers, grouped together in a pack. And I realized they'd been staring at me since I pushed my bike aboard, and none of them were smiling. And silence conquered the rumbling of the train, and I felt very white and very middle-aged, and very middle class. And a mix of guilt and fear traveled like a chill down the middle of my spine. I checked the window of the speeding train to see if I could gauge our location. A concrete wall flashed by. My heart pounded, and I started to pray on the inside while I smiled on the outside. I'm not sure what I was praying for exactly. Protection, safety, the train to pull into a station. But I centered myself somehow by talking to God, and soon I was able to hear God. And God said, "Love them, love them, love them." And my whole heart filled with love. And when one of the young men yelled, "Didn't you see that this is our car? Are you the stupidest white woman that ever rode the trains?" I answered with laughter, and I felt love pouring through the laughter, and my fear ebbed, and my heartbeat slowed. And my laughter was contagious, and half the young men laughed too. And I took a deep breath and kept praying. And the same still voice repeated in my head and in my heart and in my veins, love them, love them, love them. And then the young man who'd called out to me came forward, and he took the book from my hand, and he and I pitched in rhythm with the train, linked to the same silver commuter pole, dancers with a bicycle tire between them. And as his hand slid down, my hand reached out, and before we knew it, we were dancers holding hands. Love them, love them, love them. The young man didn't seem to notice that our hands were clasped, wrapped together around the pole for balance. And with his free hand, he held the book open and faced his friends. On the edge of their seats, in the aisles, and hanging from the handrails, they poised like an audience ready for the play's opening lines. But the actor struggled with his part. Surprised, perhaps, to be reading a God book, he stumbled with the script. And I started to help him sound out the syllables like Miss Jean Brody of the subway. I held his hand, and we swayed back and forth, body to body, spirit to spirit, struggling for equilibrium, and we sounded out God's words together, love them, love them, love them. And the seconds passed while we read together, but our show didn't satisfy the crowd, so my new young friend gave the book back to me and took a moment to think. Glancing back and forth between his expectant audience and the white woman with the book, he made a quick decision and stepped forward slightly to give himself some room. In a flash, his pants were down and his bare bottom pointed in my direction. He was tall and lean and smooth with youth, and his thrusts and sways seemed more dance than threat. "That is a beautiful hiney," I crooned. And the whole gang cheered and laughed and hooted. The young man laughed too, as he zipped his pants and turned to face me. We looked at one another, and I loved him, and I knew that he felt the love. I witnessed the flash of love recognition in his eyes. We were all laughing when the train pulled into Penn Station, and then we were suddenly silent, and an unspoken agreement drifted through the train. An acknowledgement of something hard to name because it is so simple and so complicated. And then the train stopped and the doors opened and the moment passed. And I smiled at my new friend and he smiled at me. And I pushed my bicycle off the train and started across the platform. But I soon stopped to look back. Their faces pressed against the windows. The young men watched as I turned to face them. I lifted my hand to wave, and they all waved back. And they were simply children peering from the windows of a subway train, and my heart ached with love for them.
Thank you for listening to the stories of Reverend Darlene Kelly, and thank you for your support of the Caring Hands Soup Kitchen. This program was made possible by our good friends at the Joseph E. Leahy Funeral Home, providing compassionate, professional care in Kingston, New York. Please donate today to Caring Hands, P.O. Box 1099, Kingston, New York, 12402. Or look for the Caring Hands Soup Kitchen on Facebook or online at caringhandssoupkitchen.org. More of Darlene Kelly's stories may be found on her WordPress blog, MethodistToHerMadness.com.